closet hunters among his associates in the world of New York finance, and thanks to his time spent on Wall Street, he rapidly built a steady stream of clients. Word spread quickly that Rafe delivered a high-quality outdoor experience, and he soon had a waiting list. A hunting operation is only as good as its guides, and that was an area where Rafe was able to differentiate himself from the rest of the industry. He hired the best outdoorsmen he had served with in the military, including several of the instructors from Kodiak. They were hardworking, competent, reliable, and fun to be around. The clients loved them, and they delivered. The guides received a steady stream of income while finding time to take a breath and evaluate their priorities outside the world of special operations. Rafe's goal was to connect successful businessmen, entrepreneurs, and financiers with hardened operators. This created an informal network that became known as Warrior Guardians. Those in the private sector connected to a community of talent that was unprecedented in modern society and that was often shrouded in secrecy. Both groups recognized the value in bridging the divide between those who did the fighting and those who paid for it. And more than a few internships, businesses, foundations, and fresh starts were born under the Montana skies. When the operation began hosting wounded veterans on hunts as part of a foundation funded by successful clients, the guides found even greater purpose. Bonding under the stars, these men and women, many of whom had been grievously injured by IEDs, began healing the emotional wounds of war. The business was doing well and was financially viable, but Rafe and his guide team quickly realized that they had a problem on their hands. Many of their clients, successful individuals who led busy lives, couldn't shoot very well. Wounding animals was unacceptable. So, in typical Hastings fashion, Rafe made a plan. He hired retiring instructors from the SEAL Sniper School in Indiana to design and implement a hunter training program on one of Thorne's properties outside Missoula. He made attendance a prerequisite for booking a hunt, and client performance improved drastically. Once word got out, the school took on a life of its own and was soon making more money than the outfitting business. Ironically, government contracts with special operations units provided the school's most reliable clients. The final piece fell into place when Rafe was personally guiding a client who had drawn a once-in-a-lifetime Rocky Mountain Bighorn sheep tag in the Missouri Breaks. After a tough stalk, the client's expensive custom rifle went click when it should have gone bang, and the old ram that they'd been tracking for days gave them the slip. Working in the dark by headlamp back in camp that night, Rafe diagnosed the problem. His discriminating eye noted several issues, all of which came as a shock to the client. The hunter asked Rafe if he'd be willing to build him a dependable rifle, and the former SEAL's career as a custom gunmaker was born. Reese pulled his Land Cruiser in front of the structure that served as the gunmaking shop and parked next to Rafe's Defender. He opened the metal shop door quietly. Rafe's eyes never lifted from his work as his friend entered his domain. The space was large, but not excessively so, and was filled with the various tools of the trade. Reese expected to see modern, computer-controlled machinery, but instead found himself among aging but well-maintained equipment with names like Bridgeport and Harding, relics of America's industrial age. The cast-iron hulks were painted a glossy gray and looked like something that one would encounter in the machine shop of a Navy ship. There were rifles on a rack in various stages of completion, numerous workbenches, and a hand-loading table stacked with the tools necessary for loading precision ammunition. A blue Dillon press for handgun rounds sat next to a heavy, green single stage used for rifle cartridges. Boxes of dies lined the cabinet above. Rafe was wearing a jeweler's magnified optivisor over the worn ball cap that he'd turned backward to accommodate the device. He stood over a waist-high bench vise, focused on the partially shaped blank of French walnut that was clamped inside its cork-covered jaws. He wore a heavy leather apron, and his blackened hands held a small chisel. "His coffee," Rafe said, nodding his head toward a desk against the wall, without moving his eyes from his work. "Sorry, no honey." Reese chuckled as he poured the steaming liquid into an enameled mug, painted with the Black Rifle Coffee Company's logo. He took a seat on a stool a few feet away from Rafe and watched as his friend coated a rifle's action and barrel with a thin black sludge using a small paintbrush. He then lowered the steel into the inletting of the walnut stock and tapped it with a rawhide mallet. He lifted the barreled action and examined the inletting, taking note of where the black oil had marked the raw wood. A dozen chisels, gouges, and scrapers were strewn on the bench in front of him, and he selected one. He made a series of small cuts with the razor-sharp tool before retrieving the barrel and repeating the process all over again. Reese always appreciated watching true artisans at their craft, and he sat silently as Rafe focused, gently inletting the metalwork into the wooden stock so that the two became seamlessly joined. Finally satisfied, Rafe turned off the lamp above his work and breathed a sigh of relief. "How long does it take?" Reese asked. "The inletting? A few hours. No, the whole rifle. I'll probably have 250 hours in this one by the time it's ready." "That's like 2 months." "6 weeks, but you never were a numbers guy." "Yeah, it's a lot of work, which is why I don't sell them cheap." "What will that rifle run?" "About 50 grand. "Rich kid shit," Reese smiled. "That it is."
"Where'd you learn to build rifles?"
"Back in Africa, you had to be self-reliant to survive, so I learned from doing. I wanted to get the trade right, so I spent 6 months apprenticing with Darcy Eccles in Utah.
He built the 300 Win Mag my dad gave me. He's the one.
Best there is. Jerry Fisher down in Big Fork put me in touch with him. For 2 months, all he let me do was sweep the floor and polish metal. My rite of passage, I guess. Then he took me under his wing. He sure can build a tack, driver. I need to track down that rifle. Not sure what happened to it when I skipped town. It's in my vault."
"What? How'd you get it?"
"Liz gave it to me. You left it in her plane along with some other gear. I hid it until you got pardoned so they couldn't use it as evidence."
"That was nice of you."
"Don't mention it. Figured if you got killed or went to prison, I'd at least have a nice rifle." Reese frowned. "By the way, I noticed an interesting article in a Peterson's Hunting magazine in the cabin."
"Did you?" Rafe asked.
"Looked like one of the photos was taken right across my lake, written by S. Rainsford. You wouldn't happen to know him, would you?" Rafe offered a rare half-smile. "Good catch. I do some outdoor writing under that pen name. Most don't get the reference today. Just trying to avoid the stigma of being another SEAL author. Let's go get you your rifle, eh?" Reese briefly wondered if his urge to hold the rifle again was because it was one of the few tangible links left to his father, or perhaps something darker. The last time he'd pressed its trigger, he'd sent a bullet through the brain of one of the men who had masterminded the death of his wife and child. He'd made the killing look like a hunting accident in order to buy the time he needed to cross the remaining names off his terminal list. Later that night, Reese sat alone by a fire at the water's edge, the Eccles legend across his lap. He alternated his gaze between the empty chair to his right and the mountains across the lake, a wilderness he'd never explore with his wife, daughter, or unborn son. He remained unmoving, but for his finger slowly caressing the outside edge of the trigger guard, the fire dying to embers, glowing only when the wind picked up off the lake. As the sun rose the following morning, Reese's finger continued to stroke the trigger guard. His only companions, the memories of the dead. Chapter 10. St. Petersburg, Russia. Ivan Zharkov put down the newspaper and took a sip of his tea.
He sat in a leather armchair in his bedroom, unable to sleep. His late wife would have chastised him for taking caffeine this late, but it didn't make any difference. It wasn't the powerful stimulant, nor was it the demands of his position as one of Russia's most powerful figures in organized crime that robbed him of his rest. It was Alexander. His eldest son's birth had been a difficult one for Katrina, and the depression that followed had been even worse. Ivan was too busy to notice, but in hindsight, she and the child never formed the crucial bond between mother and child. Katrina would stare out the window as the child cried, attending to his physical needs when necessary, but never nurturing his emotional ones. She became cold, distant, unattached. When she took her life with a 25 ACP Korovin TK pistol, it was a young Alexander who found her, lying in bed after just having finished the last page of Sofia Petrovna. When Ivan entered the room and grabbed his young child to shield him from the grisly sight of his dead mother, he thought the boy was in shock. He didn't accept, until years later, that it wasn't shock. It was curiosity. Alexander remained a mystery to the elder Zharkov. The boy was bright and handsome, and from the outside was everything a father could want. Inside, though, there was a darkness. Alexander could be cruel to his younger brothers. Even when they were quite young, their nannies had to protect them from him. His actions weren't out of anger or jealousy. Rather, they were for amusement. On their first hunt, north of Moscow in the ancient forests of the Yaroslavl district, Ivan's worst fears were confirmed. They had taken the train together, and 10-year-old Alexander had watched the country pass by the large windows in silence. It was a beautiful October day when the father and son ventured out from their cabin. This was a traditional European-driven hunt, meaning the hunters were assigned stands or positions, and the animals were pushed in their direction using hounds. Ivan's peg was 100 or so yards away from Alexander's, far enough away to give the boy some independence, but close enough to keep an eye on him. To commemorate the hunt, Ivan had given his son a custom 8x57mm Mauser sporting rifle that Ivan's father had brought back from the Great Patriotic War, no doubt looted from a German officer. The rifle was deeply engraved in the Germanic style and had been fitted with set triggers and a Zeiss scope in claw mounts, a testament to the proud tradition of Teutonic gunmaking. Alexander had long admired the rifle in his father's cabinet and was delighted to now call it his own. Since so few things seemed to bring him joy, it warmed Ivan's heart to see his son's eyes brighten. The distant bark of the hounds grew louder as the game was driven before them. A boar sped toward Ivan and pitched forward as he made a perfect running shot. The sound ringing in his ears in the stillness of the morning. Ivan saw a brown blur to his right. Moose! A second later, he heard the report of Alexander's rifle and the unmistakable sound of a bullet striking flesh. There was silence and then a crash, no doubt the sound of the moose collapsing. It was a break of protocol to leave one's stand before the drive was finished, but Ivan wanted to be by his son's side. He jogged toward the sound of the crash, his eyes searching for a sign of either hunter or prey. He saw the moose first, crippled with a spine shot and struggling in vain to drag itself away from its tormentor. The large mammal dwarfed young Alexander, and Ivan was afraid that the moose would stomp the youngster or bludgeon him with his palmated spread of antler. But as he approached, his concern turned to disgust. Alexander stood, without fear, watching the animal writhe in agony. He was smiling. Ivan ran to the front of the animal to give himself a safe shot and fired a round into the bull's chest, dropping him to the ground and putting an end to his suffering. Turning to face his son, Ivan slowly took possession of the Mauser, chilled by the hatred he saw burning in his child's eyes. That hatred, directed toward Ivan for ending the animal's agony prematurely, would haunt the mafia boss for the remainder of his days. Chapter 11. Petersburg Petroleum Company, St. Petersburg, Russia. Gray had been surprised by the location of his office. He knew that Zharkov effectively controlled the regional oil firm, but he wouldn't have imagined that he would find himself working openly in the headquarters of a publicly traded company. His morning commute was a relatively easy one from his flat near the city's center. His office was only a few blocks from the Piskaryovka rail station, in an industrial section of town. Zharkov expected immediate results, and Gray delivered. The first order of business was to turn over the names of all the men and women in Zharkov's organization, many of them residing in the United States, who were known FBI and CIA informants. Each would then be analyzed and evaluated for possible blackmail, or the most permanent of solutions as a warning to others. As he settled into his routine, he found it was strangely similar to his time at Langley, delivering some quick wins for Zharkov's organization, provided him a little leniency in terms of how he spent his time and resources. His most important project was a personal one. Feeling dapper in his custom suit, he strode with a newfound confidence that would have shocked his co-workers at the agency. He used his access card to enter the building and took the elevator to the executive level. As he passed her cubicle outside his office, he bid good day to his administrative assistant, Svetlana, a sturdy and attractive widow a few years his senior. She doted on him in a manner that he hadn't enjoyed since childhood, taking his coat as he walked by and fetching him tea or coffee without so much as an ask. She would straighten his tie and brush lint from the shoulders of his new suits, doing everything but licking her fingers before fixing his hair. With no social life or family to distract him, Gray devoted every waking second to his new cause: finding James Reese. His analytical brain examined seemingly endless mountains of information. He scoured the media accounts of Reese's one-man war that had left a trail of bodies from California to Wyoming, from the southern tip of Florida to the stormy New England coast. From there, Reese had vanished, only to reappear in Odessa, Ukraine, where Gray had seen him before the assassination of the former Russian president. Other than a few media references to the presidential pardon that had been issued the previous fall, James Reese was a ghost. The White House had refused to provide justification for the act, citing national security concerns, but the mere existence of that pardon all but proved Reese's involvement in thwarting the attack on the U.S. president. Save a powerful man's life and he'll forget about the few murders you committed along the way. Having exhausted his media search, Gray shifted his focus to sifting through the dry minutiae that was his specialty. A detailed search of property records led to no surviving family members. Reese was an only child, and Gray had arranged his father's death years earlier. According to an obituary run in the Flagstaff, Arizona newspaper, his mother had died in a nursing home a few months ago. The only existing property record was for his home in Coronado, and Gray confirmed that Reese was not living there. If he'd purchased a home or a car, Gray would have found it. He'd never registered on any social media platforms and didn't appear to even own a traceable telephone or have an email address. The whiteboard of Gray's office was covered with every detail he could gather from Reese's past, an algorithm of names, places, and dates. So far, he couldn't find the X, but he knew it was only a matter of time. Chapter 12. SVR Headquarters, Moscow. Alexander pulled open his desk drawer and drew out a small braided loop of hair, a memento of his first real hunt. He had been training at the Institute when he realized how much